I'm going to start. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is not Paul Johnson, it's Paul Jacobson. I was announced as Paul Johnson this morning, but it's still Paul Jacobson. I'm going to be assisted at a certain point by my good colleague here, Jeff Cohen. So I'm very lucky to have him, and he is going to be giving a concert of historical development of flutes. Not the evolution, because flutes didn't necessarily get better, they just changed, according to different demands. So he's going to talk all about that tonight. It's going to be a fascinating lecture demonstration tonight, so don't miss that. Chris, Sharon, and I have been dreaming about doing this course together for some time, a course about how music intersects with culture. And he and I come at it from different perspectives with different passions, and so our sessions will definitely complement each other. And as we go, we've entitled the series of five sessions fancifully Exploring Music in the Midst of Life, and it definitely will be sort of an exploration. It's not definitive, it's exploratory. We welcome questions, and as the week grows, there will be more dialogue. I must confess that today I'll be doing more talking and very little discussion, but if things that I say make no sense, or you have questions, what further clarification, or have a comment, feel free to break in. And I have a time this, so I, rather than running over, I'll probably just end in the middle of a sentence. sort of like an unresolved cadence, which is a great way to wake up a musician. You play a major scale and end on the seventh degree and then walk away. And that musician will, at whatever age, will bounce out of bed and race to the keyboard and have to complete the scale. Today's look, music in the midst of life. Well, I'm going to be doing more of the historical approach, especially in this first session, and Chris is going to be doing more of the contemporary look at music in the midst of life, the elements of music and how they affect us, and how we affect them. I'm going to look at a particular place, a particular time, a particular milieu, and a particular person, and of course that Sebastian is Johann, our beloved Johann Sebastian Bach. But it sort of reads like a story tale, hence Sebastian and the flute. So I thought I'd start out fancifully with a story for us, and it's an Apache folk tale. I should be in the next room with Elaine Bowie, with Leah Bowie. I'm probably breaking copyright rules, but I'm not making any money, so I'm not going to worry. This is one of our grandsons, who has this book that we like to sing, tell and sing, and it tells a story about a young Apache flutist, and it has to do with the intimate connection between music and people. We're in a culture where it's very easy to tune music in with any of our electronic devices, and music seems packaged. You can go to a concert hall and music seems out there, removed. On television, American Idol makes music seem like what a few talented people do that rise to a top through a contest. But in fact, music at its best is a very, very, very intimate thing between the listener, the performer, the composer, the instrument maker, the culture, our own personal histories, and the creation, the physics of sound. And so I'll be delving more into that. The flute player. Evening, and I'm going to do this in abbreviated fashion, and our grandson August would say, you skipped that page, Baba. The evening of the dance arrived. You already know it's within the story. And during the hoop dance, a young boy and a young girl became very, very interested in one another. People who saw them began talking, look, they don't even change partners. They only dance with each other. It was true. The boy and the girl only danced with each other. Between the dances, the boy told the girl, I play the flute. She told him, maybe someday I will hear you play your flute. When I go to the canyon to work in my father's field, when I hear you play the flute, I will place a leaf in the river that runs through the canyon. When you see the leaf float past you, you will know that I like your song. Early the next morning, the boy went to the canyon and played his flute. People working in the canyon in the cornfield said, listen, that sounds like the wind. Merikefething, blowing through the trees. I'm echoing the previous study. The girl listened to the flute player. She liked his song. She pulled a leaf from a tree, took it to the river, and gently dropped it in. She watched it float away. As soon as the boy finished playing the flute, he dashed to the water and looked for the girl's leaf. He saw it, and as it floated by, he picked it up. He put it in his belt, and he was very happy. He said to himself, she likes my playing. The next day, both the boy and the girl got up early and returned to the canyon. The boy played his flute again. The people listened and said, my, what a beautiful sound. It sounds like the wind blowing through the trees. The girl heard it too. Once again, she took a leaf from the tree and placed it in the water. Now we go to the next step, the extrapolation. As soon as he was done playing the song, he went to the river, lifted the leaf from the water, placed it in his belt, and said, she likes my song. Maybe she likes me. A few days later, the boy's uncle came to him and said, it is time you learn to hunt. It is time that you go with us instead of staying here with the women folk. So the boy went on a hunting trip. I will now skip a large part of the story in which he goes away hunting. The girl misses him. She dies. He comes back, looks for her, and he disappears. So I'll skip the sad part of the story and skip to the present. Today, we go to the canyon, down to the cornfields and the river. We sit and listen to the echoes of the canyon and watch the leaves fall into the river. Some say, listen to the beautiful sound. It sounds like the wind blowing through the trees. But we smile and know that the girl still likes the flute player. The story ends here. Nice story, huh? And what does that have to do with Johann Sebastian Bach, we ask? He had a very important mission in his vision, and that had to do with what his music was intended to do. For Bach, it was definitely a career. Bach was the son of a town piper. His father could play trumpet and violin and worked for the town of Eisenach. Was it Eisenach that his dad? Yeah, his dad worked in Eisenach and other places. And that was a very important town position, vital to, they were the klezmerim of the town. But for Bach growing up, becoming the professional career musician and earning his money that way did not become his passion. What became his passion was twofold. His passion was to have an effect on his hearers that would deepen their understanding of their faith. It was a spiritual vocation, and B, it was perfecting the tradition. He was very much of a traditionalist, and for him, his job was to look back and to glean the wisdom of what he had learned and to see what the possibilities of that tradition held. So what is the effect of Bach the teacher on us today? How does he still communicate? Well, we see it as young people pianists. Whenever young pianists get to a certain point, one of the things that's plopped on the music desk, this happened to me when I was about 8 years old, was the two-part inventions. And later on, if you're good enough, the three-part symphonias. And he wrote in the foreword of this book, sincere instruction in which lovers of the keyboard, especially those who are keen to learn, are shown a clear method, not only one, of learning to play clearly in two parts, but also, after further progress, two, of dealing well and correctly with three obbligato parts. So this is a matter of the gradus ad parnassum, the steps to the place where the musical gods live. This was a way of searching out the treasures of the tradition. Bach was a master teacher. I should add to his vocation that he also saw passing on his knowledge to his children, sharing it with his wives, I'm one at a time. it's political fast, doesn't it? And also with future generations. It became very important to him. Interestingly enough, unlike many of his peers, he never wrote a theoretical treatise. He never wrote a tutor on how to play. He didn't do much in the way of publishing at all. He wrote things for his students and for his church. Well, to start with, he is the master of harmonizing the chorale. And this has shaped modern music to be what it is. What Jeffrey and I learned in musical theory classes in college was how you harmonize a chorale in the style of Johann Sebastian Bach. One of my teachers, my first music theory teacher for my first 2 years of college was Kenneth Jennings, who was conductor of the St. Olaf Choir for many years. And he tells a story where when he was a young man working on his doctorate at Northwestern University in Illinois, he had to take a matriculation exam to get into the doctoral program. And one of the items on the matriculation exam was harmonize this melody in the style of J.S. Bach. And he looked at the melody and he said just the week before he had a church job, he had had his choir sing it. So it was in his mind. And so he said, I just wrote down Bach's harmonization. So it made it easy. Which may seem difficult, except for the fact, and he's a very smart man, KJ, Kenneth Jennings. But there is such beautiful logic in Bach's chorale harmonizations that they stick in your mind. If you hear one in the ELW, it is very distinctive. It stands out from Martin Luther harmonizations, from Walter harmonizations, certainly from 19th and 20th century harmonizations. It is distinctly Bach, and all of us emulating him can sort of catch it. But when you hear a real Bach harmonization, it's very identifiable. And he did, we have about 440 of his harmonizations. I don't know that he wrote one chorale melody himself. He was not a hymn writer. He was a harmonizer of chorales. And in so doing, he shaped the rules of four-part voice leading for all of Western tonal harmony following him. He became the Bible of voice leading and harmonization. He put together a book of organ compositions called the Little Organ Book, the Orgelbuchlein, which goes through a bunch of chorales and also liturgical pieces, and sort of gives a demonstration of how you should write an organ chorale prelude. They're not only beautiful in church, but they're a training tool. The Well-Tempered Clavier 1 and 2, more on this later, but these are two books, each of which have 24 preludes followed by 24 fugues, each of which go through the 12 major keys and the 12 minor keys. This was a rather new feat. It had only been accomplished, I think, by one composer before him, and very unsuccessfully, and really hadn't been possible until J.S. Bach for two reasons. For one thing, the way he did it was so masterful in the way he dealt with fugues and the way he dealt with all the different national possibilities for writing a prelude, which is sort of an improvisatory piece that leads into an opera or a fugue. There wasn't a way of tuning a scale such that it sounded good in all 12 major and all 12 minor keys until the time of J.S. Bach. And he was a theoretician that knew the acoustics of sound and the physical nature of sound very well and had read voluminously about tuning or temperaments, how you tune the keyboard and what it makes possible. And his two books of Well-Tempered, which means a nicely laid out and very flexible musical scale, like Well-Tempered Steel, he used these to demonstrate that it really did work to play in all 12 major and minor keys. He wrote for one of his students an exercise, a very thorough exercise, and it was only available in manuscript, and called The Precepts and Principles of Playing Thorough Bass. That student went on and made a fair copy, and it was passed from generation to generation to generation. An anecdote about the way he taught playing thorough bass, and I'll tell you what thorough bass is in a moment. From a fellow in 1790 who wrote the first comprehensive dictionary, biographical dictionary of music. His name was Gerber, as in the steel. In this dictionary, he reports on the education that his father, Heinrich Gerber, received at the age of 22 in Leipzig with Bach. He was studying law at the University of Leipzig, but he also was there because he wanted to study keyboard with a great keyboardist. Bach was so respected as a keyboardist, not necessarily as a composer, but he had already a big reputation as a keyboard player. Let's see, I'm going to skip down. The conclusion of the instruction that his father received was thorough bass, for which Bach chose the Elbenhorn violin solos that have a bass line that he was to play and realize. So more about that. And I must admit, says the young man writing the dictionary, that I have never heard anything better than the style in which my father executed these basses according to Bach's fashion, particularly in the singing of the voices. This accompaniment was in itself so beautiful that no principal voice could have added to the pleasure it gave me. So, first of all, what is thorough bass? And Jeff and I are going to demonstrate this in a little bit down the road here. It's part of what defines the Baroque era from about 1600 to Bach's death in 1750, arbitrarily, is the juxtaposition of a treble melody line against a bass line, so that you have a bass line that's melodically and harmonically supporting the treble line, and the vertical juxtaposition of melody and bass, of course, gives you harmony. Except that the thorough bass, only the bass line was written out and not all the chords. So it was almost like giving a guitar tablature, G major, except you have a bass line, and sometimes you have little numbers that tell you what the harmony should be, and sometimes there's nothing. Bach, when he realized figured bass, meaning you sit down at the keyboard, you see the bass line, and you can improvise a beautiful harmonic structure above this single bass line, and that's called realizing thorough bass or realizing continued bass. But for Bach, it wasn't just strumming chords. It was making every single voice that you created a beautiful melody in itself. And that is called voice leading. And in a Bach, pardon?
Voice what?
Voice leading.
Leading.
Which every voice leads beautifully and logically to the next step in its melody, but also is following strict rules in terms of what it's doing harmonically. So it's sort of a double rule that's going on here. So Bach was very clear that the inner structure of music was extremely important. And he's coming out of this long tradition of polyphony, many-voiced music, the music of Palestrina, and into the age of the bass line and harmony, homophonic music, chordal music, and trying to tie these two traditions together into one logical tradition. And then finally, and he never stopped being a teacher. Late in his life, he wrote a huge collection of four books called the Klavierübungen, or the keyboard exercises, a very modestly titled Keyboard Exercises. Well, those keyboard exercises, the first book are six harpsichord partitas, each of them masterpieces. The Italian concerto and overtures in the French style, very demanding pieces. Liturgical works for organ, and finally, the Goldberg variations, of which I'll play just the aria. The Goldberg variations is an aria for harpsichord with melody and figured bass. And then there are 30 variations. Each third variation is a canon, like a round. The first one is a canon at the unison. The second one is a canon at the second. The third one is a canon at the third. The fourth one is a canon at the fourth. And he sort of goes logically through this whole thing. And somehow, doing this so pedagogically and so abstractly still makes consummate music with it. So he's able to tie together theory with beauty. Here's the aria. Let's see if this works. And then there's a B section. It's just consummately beautiful, intimate music, and yet at the same time, it's so academic, it can make your head spin. So, I, by the way, have two complete recordings of the Goldberg Variations, one by a wonderful Italian harpsichordist that you heard here, and one by the famous Glenn Gould. If anyone wants to have a Goldberg Variations party, let me know. We'll play the whole darn thing. I think it's about an hour's worth of music. So one thing I discover in this is that when I go to escape from the full screen, it turns off my little audio clip, so that's handy to know. Bach came out of this tradition of, we talk about Renaissance polyphony and Baroque polyphony. Renaissance polyphony is what was happening as the plain song of the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Church, especially the Roman Church, developed multi-voice compositions on the basis of Gregorian chant, where you would have a chant cantus firmus, a chant foundation, and then you would have other vocal lines over that. These eventually even became instrumental works, but they were ways of dressing up Gregorian chant, basically with multi-voiced compositions. Some of the most exquisite of those, it came to its height, let's say, in the works of Palestrina. And Bach knew the works of Palestrina and some of his colleagues very well. And this was Bach's inheritance, Renaissance polyphony, and what had happened in the years of the early Baroque with such Lutheran writers as Heinrich Schütz and such Italian writers as Frescobaldi. He knew all these works intimately. Bach, by the way, was a workaholic when it came to study. We could talk on that for a long time, but he snuck away to study. There's a story about Bach. When his mother and father had both died, he went to live with his older brother, Christoph, in the town of Ohrdruf. And Christoph took it upon himself to be Bach's tutor. But there were, to get your musical manuscripts, you went places and you copied them out often, especially if you didn't have much money. You copied them all out by hand. There was no sheet music place to buy them. And Christoph had copied an awful lot of fine music. And some of it was by Dietrich Buxtehude. And Bach had heard Dietrich Buxtehude and wanted to play that music. But Christoph had the music rolled up in scrolls and in a desk which he closed up and locked at night. And Bach was not allowed, young Sebastian Bach was not allowed to go in there because that was Christoph's stuff. You keep your hands off my stuff. I'll teach you that when you're ready to learn. So Bach was only about 10 years old, and he would go down at night, and there was a slat where he could slip his arm through the desk and pull out the scroll and lay it out and copy it on his own paper by moonlight, and then roll it up and put it back as if it hadn't been disturbed, until Christoph one day found this cache of things that Bach had been copying. And Christoph didn't say, "Wow, that's great. You should do more of that." No, he said, "You are not to do that," and he took them all and burned them. so they were very, very protective of it. It was sort of like copyright. Those are my scrolls. You can't copy them. So, but he was very intent from the tender young age at pulling in all that he could. And this, for example, would have been a motet that he knew very well. "As the heart desires the water brooks, so longs my soul for you, O God." One of Palestrina's most sublime motets. And I'll play the first chunk of it.
Thank you.
see where Bach got his sense that every melody was important, every part of the inner music was important, because in this music that by Palestrina that magically puts together layers of melody, and somehow they all agree with each other in time and follow very strict rules of counterpoint developed gradually and perfected by Palestrina, but rules that you don't hear. What you hear is the congruence of voices. And for Bach, that was everything, that ability of voices to work together to create a greater whole. If you take this, then look at Bach's type of counterpoint, here you have in a cathedral in Rome, a boys' choir singing, in this case it was the Westminster Abbey Choir, boys and men's choir, but boys learning the music from their superiors in Rome, and that was their schooling. In Leipzig, that's how Bach taught his kids in the Leipzig school in which he taught as well. And the way what he taught his boys were his and the guys that were there, fellow teachers and older students, were his own motets. And we have of Bach surviving six motets that are now in quite a new style. And there's a story about Mozart visiting Leipzig because he'd heard that the tradition of singing Bach's motets at St. Thomas Schule was still alive and well, and he wanted to hear it firsthand. So Mozart, in 1789, 2 years before he died, was still healthy, came to Leipzig and heard Singet dem Herrn, sing to the Lord a new song, sung by the St. Thomas School boys and men, and said, and this is one of the things that's quoted in, I think, Bach's obituary, "Now there is a piece of music we can learn from." So let me just play a little bit of that. This, I can't remember which choir this is, but it's good.
I think you have to go back to
Let's have to go back. Ended abruptly like that, so that's the fade out.
The traditional Baroque studio fade.
A Baroque studio fade, right.
Yeah.
So what you see there is this, the same importance of the inner voices, the same communication, except there's one huge difference. Can anyone sort of put their finger on what, how you would say Bach's motet different from Palestrina's motet? We could all hear that they're drastically different.
I felt the bass was a clear melody.
The bass is a clear melody. The bass has a clear direction to it, and it defines this very clear harmonic movement.
Somewhat frustrated bass.
Right, a frustrated bass. I'm sure you're not frustrated. So at any rate, it's that harmonic musical language which we'll delve deeper into on Wednesday. Don't worry, it's not going to be Theory 101. It's going to be talking about what is this harmonic movement we're talking about? What does it do to us? What are the components of this harmonic movement? How does it affect us emotionally, spiritually, and so forth? We're going to try to explore this a little bit more on Wednesday. But Bach is the author of how it really works. Not the inventor, but he just brought it to the point of perfection, in my estimation. Moving right along. Don't say it. Cancel. Slideshow. Now I gotta start moving faster. One of the interesting things, I'm gonna move to, we so far haven't talked about Sebastian and the flute. How remiss of me. One of the things that we flutists are so proud of is that there is a wonderful body of music for flute alone, flute with keyboard, and flute with orchestra and vocal ensemble that Bach left behind. Oboists are so frustrated because the flutists, in Bach's case, got all of the good stuff for chamber music. And oboists try to claim it once in a while, but it's flutists that he really wrote for. That said, I should say a word about Bach and the orchestra. And that word is that for Bach, the word orchestra didn't mean a group of musicians. That he used the word orchestra in talking about music in a very interesting way. He wrote a letter to his church council in Leipzig called, and the letter was entitled, "A Short But Most Necessary Draft for a Well-Appointed Church Music." And in that draft, he pointed out that any good church should have this size choir with this many sopranos, second sopranos, altos, tenors, basses, and it should have instrumentalists that should number about 18, and they should have two or three first violins, two or three second violins, etc., two flauto traversi, two oboes, horns, trumpets, all equaling up to 18. And some of them were hired by the church, and some of them were his friends, the town pipers that he would call in upon occasion for festivals. And the word orchestra for Bach meant, and in that era, generally meant the place in the opera theater where the privileged people stood, and also the musicians. So when you talked about the orchestra, you're talking about, when you go to hear a performance these days, whether it's a play or a symphony orchestra or an opera, the highest priced tickets are the orchestra. And that's from Greek drama. The orchestra, the loge, and there's one other term that slips my mind, but they're different tiers of people according to how much they can afford and how high in society they are. But in Bach's time, when you talked about the orchestra, you were talking about music for the theater. And the orchestra was referring to the place where the musicians stood and played while the opera was going on. And for him, the sense of instrumentalists was that it was that in the well-appointed church music, you had your singers and you had your instrumentalists, and they worked together hand in hand. But Bach developed early on, after, especially when he was in his one of his early church calls, he made trips to Dresden, because Dresden had a very famous orchestra, and that orchestra had brought in its wind players, by and large, from France. And France was known for its flutists. And so Bach heard this one very famous flutist by the name of Bouffardin, who was the virtuoso of the time, around the 10s and 20s, 1710s and 1720s. And Bach heard Bouffardin, and many people think that he wrote this partita for solo flute, the flute traversiere, or the flauto traverso, which is what Jeff and I were playing on last night, the flauto traverso. And so somewhere around 1717 or so, Bach wrote this piece, and we don't know for whom he wrote it or why he wrote it, but we know that he was probably inspired by the flute playing in Dresden. It touched him very personally. And the interesting thing about this partita, which in facsimile version fits very neatly onto two pieces of paper. The nice thing about reading from facsimile is that it takes so little paper and you don't have to do much page turning. Modern editions, you have to do a lot of page turning. But it starts out here, and this is not in Bach's hand, but it probably is written out by one of his students from a much rougher copy. And it is really from the year 1939 and on, it has been sort of the vadimekum of modern flutists. We've all been trying to get the better of this piece, right, Jeff? It's always, it never ceases being a challenge. And that was not the case for people that wrote for flute in Bach's time. When you wrote for flute, you were writing for either for a professional in an orchestra, or just as likely and more often, you were writing for some aristocratic fellows that liked to pass their time in their salons playing flute. So it was made for sale, and a lot of it was, most of it didn't begin to be as much of a lifelong challenge as this. So this is, Bach wrote lots of partitas for violin and harpsichord and viola da gamba cello. This is the only one he wrote for flute. I'll play just a few measures. This is an allemande. An allemande is a dance that's named after Allemagne, which is an old term for part of Germany. And it's a standard dance in any suite of dances in the 18th century. It's a walking dance. Now, the interesting thing about this is that it's not very dance-like. It's definitely not any longer a dance piece as if French composer would have written, but it's a performing piece and an exercise piece. The corrente, which he names, which starts where? Starts right there, squeezed in. It's funny, the first title is allemande, which is French. The second one is corrente, which is an Italian term. So Bach was very fluid in how he used French and Italian. He went back and forth. And so forth. I'm not going to get into trouble by playing anymore. But it's a corrente is a running dance, a very active dance. And so he captures the essence of that dance there, but he, again, doesn't make it danceable. The sarabande, which is squeezed down Oh, that's on the next page. It's not there. Section of this sarabande. Sarabandes are dance that came into Western culture maybe from the Portuguese bringing it back from the New World. It's associated with South America and it was thought to be a very sensuous dance. And then he ends with a little bourée in an English style. It's a funny thing, this partita in A minor. I'm glad it's only four movements long, because if I play it in its entirety, I'm usually exhausted by the end of it. And he tires you out really early, because at the end of the first movement, he comes up to a high A, which is the highest note on this flute, which oftentimes doesn't play too well. So you get to the end of that first movement of the partita, and the one thing you're worrying about is, will my high A sound?